God, in the 21st century, it's a very topical subject because we seem to be forgetting God so much in our society nowadays. Brother Clyde, please.
Well, thank you, Malcolm, and that was an appropriate introduction. I have been considering this particular subject for some time now, God in the 21st century. And I had originally thought of maybe talking about the major religions of the day. You know, what religions are there, worldwide religions, that we could look at and say, well, God is Allah, or God is Buddha, or God is the triune God of traditional Christianity, or God is the New Age God, or any number of topics that we could look at, and different gods that we could look at. And I have a little problem, because the world that I live in, really, there's not a whole lot of chat about God. We have some good neighbors that live on our street who are really good folks, but you would have a very difficult time getting any kind of a discussion out of them about God. Now, there is a Christian, sort of Christian family that lives down the street, and the only one that we know of for sure, and I think they are the only ones on the street for sure, other than us, who have any type of attendance at a church or go out on Sunday morning. I have a lot of business associates who are very fine folks who, once again, you have a very difficult time getting any type of a discussion about God out of them. As a matter of fact, once you start to talk about God, there is a really kind of difficult silence, awkward silence, as if, what are you talking about this for, Clyde? It's really a taboo subject. And that was true in the 25 years I spent at the community college. You couldn't get a discussion out of anyone about God. As a matter of fact, the only person that I got any kind of a discussion out of at the college was a gal who actually passed away this last week. I saw her name in the obits, and she was Buddhist. And so we used to have some discussions about concepts of God in the staff lunchroom. It's very, very difficult to get any type of exchange at all about God. Now, for me, I guess, I find God in many ways. I find God in the book that we call the Bible, which I've read for most of my life. I find God in a garden. I find that the expressions that in my work of God in a garden tells me a lot about what happened in the beginning and what the relationship was between mankind and God who created. Now, we'd like to come back again in a few moments to Genesis chapter 3, because when I started to think about, well, what kind of a reading should we have for this title, God in the 21st Century, and the first chapter I thought of was Genesis chapter 3. And as Malcolm has already alluded to, there are some very, very strong parallels between what we read in the very beginning and God in the 21st century. So God in the 21st century, we'll come back to the garden in a few moments. I have to kind of move in sort of another domain for a few moments, because I have to tell you about an outhouse I was in on a construction site some months ago. Now, I wouldn't share a lot of the stuff on the walls of outhouses with you in a forum like this, but there are also some very, very insightful comments there. And this day, when I was using the facility, there was this sign on the wall that said, "There probably isn't any God. So stop worrying and enjoy life." Now, if there was any concept about God in the 21st century, this would probably sort of do it, maybe. Now, I think that's true to say that this would sum up where most people are, certainly in our society, and I'm talking about you know, the west coast of British Columbia. This may be different in other parts of the world, but there probably isn't any God, because we don't really have any other sort of definitive way of saying it, so we use the word probably. Now, I have to say that when I came back sometime later to the same facility, somebody had insightfully crossed out the word probably. Now, there's a very good reason for doing that, because they had then opened up another line of script to add some other words. And other people sort of wrote in their thoughts about what that word should be. There maybe isn't any God. So stop worrying and enjoy life. Now, the whole problem of this is that if there is kind of a lurking doubt, which for most people there kind of is, a lurking doubt, there's very few people that will say, no, there is no God. So what would the word be? Would it be there's possibly, maybe, probably no God? Is it most likely that we should see life in terms of no God and therefore we should stop worrying and enjoy life? So this is a vexing problem. Now, I know when we were in the bank the other day, and I know that if you have a credit union or your bank that you work, you go to, there's probably a sign that says that the interior of the bank and the tellers are under video surveillance. And that's not a probably. You know, it's like if you went to rob the bank, you say, well, they're probably not going to see me. Maybe they wouldn't see me. It's most likely that I could get into the bank, rob the bank, and get out, and nobody would see me. Well, there's more than a lurking doubt in that, because most people say, no, there's no sense going in now, and bank robberies have dropped dramatically because the tellers are under surveillance. Is there definitely no God? Because if it was definite, then we could, without lurking doubt, we could just simply stop the worry and the concern and the doubt about God and the whole idea of guilt and get on with enjoying our lives. Is there absolutely no God? More definitive, obviously. Then we could stop worrying about God because he simply doesn't exist. And what would be the alternate? Would be the option in our life. What would we be doing? Well, getting on with enjoying life, whatever we have, to the best of our ability. And so these were words that I copied down. Definitely, absolutely, possibly. So why do people worry? Because there is a nagging doubt. There is an element of doubt. Now, I was at a ball game recently for one of our grandson's ball games, and there was a dad there who actually, I believe, is a Vancouver Island manager for FedEx, and he's in charge of specifically air movement of product in and out of Lower Vancouver Island and Vancouver Island in general, and spends quite a bit of time on the airplanes, not just freight planes, but on passenger flights in and out of destinations around sort of the Pacific Northwest. And somebody in the bleachers was talking about airplane disasters and frightening experiences on airplanes. And he said, well, recently, early this spring, late winter, they were flying into Seattle in a small plane. And they got into a terrible storm. Now, here's a gentleman that's in the air all the time with small planes, and this was the worst he'd ever seen. He said it was so bad, the airplane was slipping from side to side, it was bouncing up and down, it was vibrating violently. He said the woman across the aisle was throwing up into a bag. He said the woman that was sitting beside him was screaming at the top of her lungs. He says, as a matter of fact, Clyde, he says, I think I still got part of one of her nails in my arm here. And he said, and me, he said, I was praying hard, he said. Like, I was really praying, you gotta believe me, he says. Praying, and he says, I'm not even religious. So here again, you see, there is this kind of nagging doubt that's out there that somehow or another, there may be a God. Just maybe. And that is a vexing problem. Well, for those of us who read the Bible, we know that there is a there is a definition of this problem. And Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11 to 12, what God tells us is that we can sort of run, but we can't hide when it comes to this issue. God is eternal. God was there in the beginning. And because God is eternal, he will be there in the end. Whether that's at the very beginning of time, whenever that was, or whether it's in the 21st century. And this is actually a burden that God has laid on men. It's an inescapable burden. God made everything beautiful. If we go back to Genesis chapter 1 and 2, this beautiful creation that begins with the statement that in the beginning, God. And it was all done in good order and said to be very good. In 5 days of creation, the record tells us, God put all this together. And then he created man on the sixth day, and he put and set eternity in the hearts of men. So there was a kind of a biological, genetic kind of gene that said there is a God in the hearts and minds of all mankind from the very beginning of time. So this was what we might call guilt or something like that, but it's sort of a connection that all mankind has towards some type of superior being. So he has put eternity within the hearts of men, and yet they can't, or they won't, or they don't wish to fathom and to understand what God has done from beginning to the end. Human beings from the beginning of time, starting in Genesis chapter 3, as a matter of fact, have really said, well, that may be true, that God did make everything beautiful, that God did create man and put him on the earth. But, you know, we want to not believe it, essentially. We'd like to get about our lives and not really believe it. Well, let's go to the first few chapters of Genesis. And for a few moments, just keep our Bibles open from Genesis 1 and 2. God creates the world. He creates everything that's in it. He creates the fish that swim in the ocean. He creates the beasts that walk on the land. He creates the birds that fly in the heavens. He creates the green grass. He creates every herb. He creates the trees. He develops the topography of the earth and sets up the oceans and sets up the boundaries of the oceans and the continents. He puts that all together. And then on the sixth day, in verse 26 of chapter 1, God says, let us make man in our image. Now, this, of course, is a great statement that maybe is a great statement of theology, but it's a practical statement to this extent that God says, I've got this beautiful creation that I've made here, and I need somebody to take care of it. So the word rule comes in there. I have in chapter 1, verse 26, God says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let him rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over the livestock and over all the earth. Now, we have a bit of a problem right away with the word rule, and this comes back to our whole idea of what people think about God in the 21st century. This word rule, I believe, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but in every place I look to try and find a definition of it, rule means rule. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. I think it's probably a good thing, because you think about it, that God had the creative genius to make the world and then to make a man or human beings to put them on that world, then you would think that being created in the image and likeness of God, that those human beings that he put on the earth would have the capability of looking after God's creation in a proper, orderly manner. And I think really that's what it says. It was their job not to destroy it, not to use it up, not to abuse it, but in fact to fill it. And this is in verse 28 of chapter 1. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. And again, the word rule. Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and everything and every creature that moves upon the ground. So it's a consistent statement. It makes sense. And these creatures that God had created, these special creatures on the sixth day, were certainly capable of doing a good job of taking care of God's creation. Now, one of the things that they were told to do was to increase in number. So you couldn't just make a whole world and put a man and a woman on it and say, well, that's it, you can take care of this thing. That wasn't God's intention anyway from the beginning. His intention was to fill it. So he formed it, and then he wanted to fill it. He was going to fill it not with snakes or goats or sheep or fish or birds, but to fill it with the descendants of the man and the woman. Okay, so God creates man. He sets man over the creation. He then looks at man's duties. In chapter 2, we can read about it in verse 18, for example. The man became the first what we would call taxonomist. He was there naming everything and ordering everything in the garden. You can read about that in verse 16 and verse 15 of chapter 2. And then he said that it is not good for the man to be alone, and so cast around to try and find a suitable helper for the man. And he did not find that helper for the man in the birds of the air or in the fish of the sea, or for that matter in the beasts of those creatures that walked upon the land. An elephant wasn't going to be useful, or a monkey, or a horse. There had to be some special creation that could be brought to the side of the man to help him and to be a suitable helper, as my New International Version says in verse 20. The man gave names to all the livestock, birds of the air, and the beasts of the field. But for Adam, no helper was found. So the Lord causes a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he creates from the side of Adam Eve, or the woman. And he declares in verse 23, "This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman. She was taken out of man. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." So it was this perfect unity between this new creation with the man, and they lived alone in this garden. Now, in chapter 3, and again, as I said before, if I was thinking about, well, what kind of a chapter are we going to use for an introductory reading to a topic like God in the 21st century, to me it would have to be Genesis chapter 3, because there is in Genesis chapter 3 what I call the big flip. And it's pretty obvious, really, because when we started at the beginning of chapter 1, we had God, and we had the creation, and God made the creation, and then we had the man created and the woman created and put over the creation. Now, in this particular community, we've been discussing these first few chapters of Genesis recently in our Bible classes, and so we're familiar with the outline that is presented to us here. However, when we get to chapter 3 and verse 1, you'll notice that it's not the man, it's not God, it's not the woman, but it's in fact the serpent, which is in chapter 3, verse 1. So you would think with this harmonious, beautiful situation that had been developed at the end of chapter 2, this thing was going to work. You had a creation, you had the man, you had a helper. They had been united in the purpose of God to fill and manage the earth. But we go into chapter 3, and the first thing we see is the serpent. The creature from creation is the first to have a word in chapter 3. And then the woman speaks. And then the man speaks. And then you'll notice that when we get down to about verse 14 of chapter 3, that God starts to speak again. God spoke in the beginning. He instructed the man, who was supposed to instruct the woman, who set up this order to manage the earth. But in chapter 3, it's the woman, it's the serpent that starts to speak, and then it's the woman, and then it's the man that speaks, and God ends up talking towards the end of this chapter. Now, the sad thing is that, well, everything was created beautiful in its time. It was inverted almost immediately. We don't have more than two chapters of Scripture before this whole thing is sort of, as we might say today, turned on its ear. And there were clearly some huge consequences to this. And I'd like to sort of, again, think about the third chapter of Genesis and a few chapters that come after this as being somewhat of a definition of God in the 21st century. God says to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed, and there's some important words that come up here, crawl, and enmity. Now, the word enmity means antagonism, basically. You think of a harmonious creation in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, with the man sitting in the garden and all the animals and the beasts and the birds coming to him and sorting out the sort of the taxonomy and where everybody sat and all of this. There was clearly no great antagonism between men and beast. But the result of this account was that enmity came in between mankind and the beast. Well, an antagonism certainly, but I think we could also add the word suspicion. And so as Genesis goes along and gets even to chapter 10, man is hunting the beasts. As it goes along, and even as chapter 3 ends, there is a beast that is being killed. Its blood is being shed because skins are created to cover the man and the woman. So when God said, cursed, you will crawl, and enmity and antagonism, this is exactly the outcome of what happened to the beasts and the relationship between the beasts and mankind upon the earth. Now the beast, of course, in the Bible becomes symbolic of what is evil, and that enmity was spoken of by our presiding brother Malcolm in his prayer when he talked about Jesus Christ, for example. Well, there is some deep theology in here because we're going to have a seed of the serpent, descendants of the serpent, which of course, God said we're going to crawl and be cursed and there would be enmity, but certainly symbolically there would be seeds of the serpent who would try and flip the order and move in where God should be. And there was going to be this distance or antagonism because the woman was going to have a seed as well, but that's not so much the point we want to make here this evening. The consequences of the flip to the woman, as God begins to talk to her now, in Genesis 3:16, and again the order is reversed. To the woman, he said, you will increase pain through childbearing. So the woman's role now was to bear the children, to help to increase the people and the human beings living on the earth. She would experience the specific pain of childbearing, and her role would no longer be to communicate and talk to the serpent as she had, but her desire was to be to her husband as God intended it, and she was to live in subjection now to her husband. And that was because she had listened to the serpent and had taken her direction from the serpent instead of from her husband, Adam, who took his direction from God. Again, in reverse order, then God talks to Adam. And in this narrative, God actually talks to Adam first. He singles Adam out. He didn't say, so Adam and Eve, where are you? They were hiding in the garden, of course. He said, Adam, where are you? Verse 9 of chapter 3. Because Adam had the responsibility for this situation. Because you listened, God said, the ground will be cursed. Now, before, there was this Eden, whatever that meant. The fruit grew on the trees. They could go in and take fruit off the trees. There were trees that were specified, clearly the implication is that there was food in abundance. They didn't seem to eat meat at that point in time. That seemed to come a bit later in chapter 3. But there was food in abundance. It says in verse 18 of chapter 3, you will eat plants of the field. In saying that, God is saying that you're not going to be able to just reap the harvest of food from abundantly from the garden. You're going to actually have to go and till it. You're going to have to go and work the ground. And verse 18 also says, and by the way, it's not going to be that easy because it's going to produce thorns and thistles. And you are going to work and sweat. And sweat means sweat, even if you check the Hebrew, I believe. And you're going to do that, God said, until the day you return to the ground. You came out of the ground, by the way, you're dust, and you're going to go back to the dust again. Now, this is something that I know a certain amount about, and I'd like to come back and dwell on this particular point in a few moments, God willing. But the ground was now going to be cursed as a result of this. And so from here on in, human beings were going to work, are going to live based upon how they could manage the ground and how it would produce for them. And again, I'm going to say, not completely tongue-in-cheek here, as far as God in the 21st century is concerned, but he said, you're going to do that until you return to the ground. Now, the idea of retirement is something that is fairly recent, I think, in life. And certainly there was no idea of that in the curse that was placed upon Adam. And you know what I'm talking about, because I went into McDonald's to get a coffee last week, and practically everybody in there was over 65. So people are now working, not tilling the ground, but certainly many are going to work until they die. I think that's relevant, actually, because that just happens to be the way it is in the 21st century. And there may be a future career for me there. But certainly the whole thing has now changed for the man. Now, there's a whole series of consequences in relation to this flip. And let's just go through them quickly here. First of all, there's a whole new relationship between the man and the woman at the end of chapter 3, because now they've got clothes on. And they're thrown out of the garden. This pristine world where they could have their food and so on so easily. Eden was closed, chapter 3 of Genesis, verse 23. And then an interesting account is given of the first two offspring of Adam and Eve. We have Cain and Abel. So now they were multiplying. The two of them had become four. And one of the boys was a tiller of the field, which is exactly what God had said to Adam, that it would be in the sweat of his brow, he would till the soil, and he would eat from the plants of the field until he died. The other son, Abel, was a shepherd. He ruled the beasts. So in chapter 4 of Genesis, the beasts and the field are now being brought into subjection by the two sons of Adam. And we can come back to that again in a moment. The result of that enmity was that animals were being slain. There was an offering of an animal that was slain by Abel and brought to sacrifice to the Lord. So you can certainly see how there was this animosity now and this relationship between men and beasts that had dramatically changed. And then out of this relationship, we got jealousy and murder. And so man became a murderer. And then we're told in chapter 4, verse 12, that Cain was exiled from the ground. Verse 11, now you are under a curse and driven from the ground. So Cain, it would appear, no longer had even this option of being able to till the soil to produce his food because he rebelled against God because he wasn't happy with God, basically, and he killed his brother, he's now driven from the ground. In verse 12, when you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you, and you will be a restless wanderer on the earth. So it's not only that Cain would be able to till the ground and get crops. What God is saying, you'll be driven from the ground because when you do it, you won't get any crops. It just won't produce for you. And what did Cain do? He went and built a city. He moved from the land into town and built a city. Chapter 4, verse 17. Now, again, if we wanted to say, well, let's have a couple of chapters from the scriptures to read about God in the 21st century, we could add Genesis chapter 4 to this as well. Because that is a massive worldwide trend today. Even in British Columbia, which has so much land, rural area, the concentration of people are moving towards the cities. There are cities in the world, in India and places like that, that have 20 million people, in excess of 20 million people, all in one concentrated place. This isn't God's idea of the world, I don't think. That seems to be related to the evil side of the outcome of man's relationships with himself and with God. Polygamy and some interesting variations of the marriage thing come up in chapter 4, verse 23. And then if you flip over a page or two, you find that the world had got so quick, bad so quickly from chapter 4 to chapter 6 that God could say in verse 5 of chapter 6 that the wickedness on the earth had become so great that every inclination of the thoughts of the heart of man were only evil continually. Six chapters in, well actually verse chapter 3 to 6, in three chapters, we'd gone from the beautiful creation in Eden to this horrible situation where in verse 6 of chapter 6, the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth and his heart was filled with pain and he has to wipe mankind off the face of the earth and he does it with a great flood. The earth was corrupt in verse 11 in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become and how corrupt the people had become and he destroyed them and saved only Noah and his family. And in chapter 10, we have man re-gathered, reorganized, now not just building cities, but building towers. And there was something very negative about that too, we find, because their ambition was to build towers high enough to get up to God. Now I wanted to just go back for a few more minutes and have a look specifically at three of these areas of concern from the first few chapters of Genesis. Remember, the directive to the man and the woman was to increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it. Those were fairly specific instructions. Now to increase in number, they had to have children. And because they were now going to die, they had to have more children than the loss was through death. Otherwise, there'd be no increase. But it seems at the beginning of time, there had to be quite a few more children in order to create that increase in a fairly rapid manner of time. But that was the directive of God in the beginning. And this one issue, and I don't wish to belabor it, but I believe it is an important issue when we consider what man's concept of God is in the 21st century. I believe the most compelling reason to believe that man considers himself to be God in the 21st century, and I'm not sure we're answering our question, but maybe we are when we talk about God in the 21st century, is the war in the womb. And I use this term because a friend of mine mentioned this to me a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. We know, for example, that there were 50 million people approximately killed or perished in World War II. Now, those numbers are, you know, fairly accurate, I guess. About 50 million souls perished since World War II. in the international, pretty much international Holocaust that took place. We do know, we have statistics that tell us that 50 million children have been terminated in the womb since 1973. And that was the year when the Supreme Court of the United States passed a law that was called Roe versus Wade and basically made abortion fairly accessible. Now, when we say 50 million, that is a horrendous thing to say because it is really understated. I saw an article recently from a cardinal from Spain who was lamenting the fact that in the same period of time, 40 million abortions had taken place in the country of Spain. Now, that is a horrendous statistic when you consider the population of Spain in relation to the population of the United States. And you can add to that all the countries of the Western world. Now, the reason I mention this is obvious, I think, and that is that when God said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it, this is a direct challenge to the God who created mankind. Birth rates in Western countries are running on average about 1.6 children per woman. Now, that is a kind of an average statistic. It's better than that in some countries, and it's worse in others. The United States is running about 2.1 to 2.1, depending on how those statistics come up. Other countries, like Spain, are running about 1.3, 1.4. Canada, I think, is about 1.5, 1.6, sort of about the average. Now, the problem with that is that civilizations cannot sustain themselves unless they're looking at birth rates of 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, and that would be a minimal sustaining level. So it's clear that if women, and I'm going to add men to that too, but I'm certainly going to have to say women because they were commissioned with the business of bearing children, if they had a choice, if they have a choice, clearly that choice would mitigate against God's command to increase in number and fill the earth. So it's quite clear that family planning in the 21st century, in the 20th and 21st century, is against reproduction. And you can add into that countries like China, which also have a very low birth rate, and you find that this concept is sweeping the world. And it would appear that it is directly related to prosperity and lifestyles. People who protest, I'm sure, on the streets to save the spotted owl or to save the polar bear are involved in one of the greatest population reductions probably in history. There's no sense worrying about the polar bears because there won't be enough Canadians around in a few years to even bother with them. Now, you know, the Mother Earth worshippers who have this other view of God, which there's a few of those around, they're actually quite happy about that because they figure that man's the one that's the problem with the earth anyway. So we get rid of man off the earth, well, then the animals could take it over and everything would be great. Now, I love this because there's been a war going on in the city of Victoria, a weed war. And we've been fairly good with chemistry in the last 50 years, I guess, in dealing with the curse on the land, that is to say, the weeds, the weed problem. And now in the city of Victoria, there's a bylaw that eliminates any use of herbicides. And so you can't spray your lawn. If you have weeds in your lawn, you can't. In the city of Victoria, it's illegal, and there's like, you know, $2,000 fine, so it's not even worth bothering with. But now, of course, the letters are coming into the newspaper saying, well, what about all these weeds in the boulevard? The headline was Boulevards of Broken Budgets. Well, they don't have the budgets, but the problem is they don't have the tools either to deal with the weeds in the boulevard. So Victoria officials are wondering what to do with kilometers of increasingly neglected boulevards. We've got agribusiness and chemistry to mitigate against the sweat of land management. But it turns out that in the 21st century, we're probably going to lose control of that one as well, because if we take away the tools of agribusiness and those tools that have allowed us to get away from the land and to go back into the cities and have fewer people managing the land, if we take those away from us, which it looks like they will, then we have a problem with that. Now, Cain's answer, again, was to build cities and move from the land into cities. And when we think about God in the 21st century, we need to think about Revelation 18, verse 19, because Revelation chapter 18 is really God talking about the cities. You know, in chapter 3 of Genesis, he talked about the man, the woman, and the beast. In Revelation chapter 18, he's talking about the cities. These great cities, which are full of towers. We love to build towers. We love to build cities. We love to get away from the land and move into cities. In the 21st century, we believe that God is going to reverse this. It's going to flip back the other way. And here is a progression that we don't have time to look at in terms of all of these verses. But cities are going to be removed. There's only one city that seems to survive in God's kingdom. I'm, of course, making a parallel and drawing a parallel between the 21st century and God's kingdom on earth, when all of this will be reversed and put back into the Garden of Eden. This is God in the 21st century. Not man, but mankind and all of his ideas and ways of doing things are going to be displaced, and that flip is going to take place, and God is going to come back and remove the cities, and the whole world is going to be returned to Eden. And we might want to turn to Isaiah chapter 35, because we can quickly find some specific language there about this event. Isaiah chapter 35. In verse 1, the desert and parched land will be glad, the wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus, it will burst into bloom, it will rejoice greatly and shout for joy, and so on. This is the return to Eden. And people are going to return to this Eden. Well, people were driven out, the man and woman were driven out of Eden in Genesis chapter 3. They're going to return to this new Eden. It says in verse 9 of chapter 35, and again, we're talking about wild beasts and so on, won't be found there, but only the redeemed will walk there. And in verse 10, the ransomed of the Lord will return, and they will come to Zion with singing, and everlasting joy will crown their heads. And so this migration out of Eden to man's domain is going to be reversed, and people are going to come back with joy and singing into God's domain. And Isaiah chapter 65 and verse 25 tells us that there will be a harmony that will be reestablished between animals and mankind. And Isaiah chapter 2 verse 4 tells us that the kingdom of God is going to be established in Jerusalem, and that's the only city that's mentioned in the kingdom of God. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 22 talks about everlasting righteousness which will come upon the earth. And again, I'm going to suggest that this will be in the 21st century. I hope and pray it will be. In the early part of the 21st century. But there will be everlasting righteousness upon this earth. And so what we had in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, and only existed there in the Bible, will return. And there will be harmony between God and man, where we're told that God will actually come in Revelation 21 and verse 3 and live with men upon the earth. And the earth will be healed, Revelation 22 and verse 1 to 4. And the nations that are on the earth will be healed by the trees of life that will be in this garden. And Jesus Christ, as Malcolm mentioned in his opening prayer, will return to the earth to rule over that kingdom. And he's coming back to do that. So God will be reestablished on earth in the 21st century, over the ruins of the earth that man has created and that man has left behind. And the question for us is, God in our lives and ruling in our lives in the 21st century? Because if he is, then we are preparing ourselves for this great change that is going to take place, God willing, very soon.